all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
And welcome back to the second hour of Up North News Radio. It's Tuesday, April 11th, and coming up this hour, a review of last week's elections results show why the Democrats and progressives and allies should be getting active right now in a couple of key congressional districts in Wisconsin. We'll talk to Scott Ross, who for years led the liberal group One Wisconsin Now, with his assessment of how competitive these districts can be and why it's important for folks to be out and about, give constituents the option to look at somebody other than Brian Stile and Derek Van Orden to represent them in 2024. Also, Hans Breitenmoser and Tara Dunn of the Wisconsin Farmers Union talk about the importance of watershed protection, especially as farmers are getting set to start their spring planting. And Chad Holmes will join us from Bull Falls Radio in Wausau near the end of the hour. Coming up tomorrow on the program, State Representative Francesca Hong on things that the legislature could be doing to help with workforce and small business development, if they weren't busy doing some of the dumbest things ever done in the building, like proposing to give loaded weapons to teachers. We'll also talk to cancer survivor Laura Packard, who's on a national bus tour that's coming to Wisconsin this weekend, coming to the 3rd Congressional District with a message for Congressman Derek Van Orden: leave Americans' health care coverage alone. We'll get into that and more if we want to talk about it at some point. Our number is 844-967-2789, or you can email us radio@upnorthnewswi.com. And with that, we turn to our friend Scott Ross, best described by Jessica Van Egren, I believe it was, as an agent provocateur once upon a time. Ross, you still wear that label proudly?
Yes, of course I do, Pat. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me on your wonderful show. And I'm glad to hear that the message that the activist is delivering to Derek Van Orden has, you know, sort of single syllables, because otherwise he wouldn't be able to understand it.
Look, you and I and many others, but I'm going to go ahead and put you at the top of the list. At best, I'm 1B, you're 1A. On the list of people frustrated that the National Democratic Party might have exited the 3rd Congressional District campaign a little too soon last year based on, you know, rumors and whispers about polling rather than actual support. Is that a fair description?
It is fair. I mean, I think that at this point, relitigating 2022 is about as helpful as relitigating 2020. But the message is very clear, Pat. If Democrats are provided the resources from the national donors, from the DC donors, in order to compete in these elections, they are competing, they are getting the right candidates, and they are winning. And that is certainly what the case was in 2022. There was no national DC help for Brad Paff, and Brad Paff lost in a squeaker. But the good news is, you know, we saw incredible turnout on last Tuesday. And all signs point to the fact that Derek Van Orden, if the right investment is made there, is going to be a one-termer, which is exactly what a terrorist insurrectionist like Derek Van Orden should be a zero-termer. But we have the greatest opportunity to make him a one-termer. As you know, Pat, somebody who's been in the business for a long time and observed it for a long time, the best opportunity you have to take out an elected official is in their first reelection. You know, all the stars are pointed in the right way. And, you know, the great news, and I said the good news, the great news is that the Democrats in D.C., the DCCC, Democratic campaign arm, has already put Van Orden and 1st Congressional District member Brian Stile on their 33 seats that they are targeting. So this is really, really good news. And the results, I mean, that was before the results we had on Tuesday, you know, so they should be running here to assist.
Without a doubt. And obviously, I don't mean to spend a lot of time looking back at 2022, but there are lessons that we can glean from that. And now we talked so much about the 3rd Congressional District last year because Ron Kind was retiring. That seat was going to be open. It had always been seen as competitive. Folks don't talk that much about the 1st Congressional District, but it too is far from being a deep red district, right?
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the thing is, like, Pat, I mean, those who, you know, ignore the past are destined to repeat it, right? The 1st Congressional District is a perfect embodiment of that. I came to Wisconsin in July of 1997. So I'm a newcomer. And when I got here, like it was Paul Ryan running for Congress. Okay, he was running for Congress, and he got in 1998. He beat a woman down in the first congressional district, Lydia Spotswood, and then from there was never challenged again by the Democrats. I mean, he literally was. I cannot remember any concerted effort to hold him accountable on a daily basis to ensure that there was a discussion about what he was representing, what he was assisting, how he wasn't standing up for the people of Wisconsin and certainly the people of the first congressional district. And lo and behold, what happens 20 years later, he's the Speaker of the House, And so we have to challenge these elected officials in Congress on a daily basis. And I'm so glad to see, programs like yourself are out here discussing the issues. You're not putting your foot on, you're not putting your hand on the scale. You're discussing the issues. Right now, the discussion is one way because, the mainstream media doesn't feel that they have to cover these guys, other than, sending out like what they have to say in their press releases. And in the first CD, there's an enormous opportunity. I mean, that's one that the percentage actually got better for the Democrats in terms of redistricting. But, Jana Prosewitz won 3 of the 5 counties in the first congressional district. And she nearly won Racine. Walworth, which is a dark blue county, she got 46% there. The turkey is on the table, as Mike Lang, the former voice of the Pittsburgh Penguins, would say.
There you go. Scott Ross is our guest. We'll talk more about what 2024 looks like if groups and parties want to work at it. We'll take a break. We'll have a weather update from our meteorologist, Jennifer Wachitsky, and more after this. You're up north. With Scott Ross in just a moment to talk more about a couple of key congressional districts and Janet Protasiewicz's win and turnout and organization and messaging. But first, we are going to revel in the glory of the warmth that has enveloped Wisconsin. Spring has officially sprung. It's not that we're not going to have some cool days. We most certainly are, as Jennifer Wachitsky is about to tell us from Weatherology. But the gorgeousness cannot be denied, Jennifer, and it's nice to have you here. Good morning. What would you like to tell us about Wisconsin weather on this really nice, warm morning?
Yeah, absolutely. Very mild here for the next several days. I mean, you really said it. It's really going to be a pretty nice forecast here for the next several days. We're looking at a mild one for this time of the year for the entire state today, and looking at a warm front pushing through the area to the north and a high pressure system off to the south, bringing in with it some southerly winds in that heat. However, keeping that moisture at bay. So it looks like a dry forecast really here for at least until the end of the work week. Above average for everyone, sunny skies, breezy, and in the upper 70s from Amory Baldwin down to Richland Center and over to Milwaukee. Still sunny and breezy with highs around 80 for the next couple of days, just a little bit cooler by Friday, but still well above average as most of the state should be in the low to mid 50s instead. Essentially the same, more centralized in the state with cloud cover today, but clearing by tonight around Wausau, Wisconsin Rapids, but also sunny and around 80 for the next couple of days, slightly cooler by Friday as well. Chance for some rain for most by Friday. The western parts of the state will start to see it first. Slight chance for that in the afternoon hours, then more of a chance for coming in the nighttime for the central and eastern portions of the state. Then a chance for some rain to start off the weekend on Saturday and cooler as that cold front actually comes into the area. A pretty big drop in temperature, still a decent amount above average for most, but then more average around the mid to upper 50s, closer to the west around Baldwin and Amory.
Yeah, it is one of those cases where the, it's a shame that this particular weekend is going to be a little cooler and potentially rainy. But, just to remind folks that while it's really nice during the weekdays, the fishing opener is not that far away. And there's nothing that says the fishing opener weekend couldn't be the one that's drop dead gorgeous. We'll just have to wait and see. But we're getting into a really good phase of year, Jennifer, when it comes to, where we're going to get the warmth versus where we're going to get the rain.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, as long as that snow stays away, I'm good.
Yeah, there was none of that horrible stuff in the forecast there. So, Jennifer, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks to you.
All right, Jennifer, we'll talk to you again tomorrow from Weatherology. Scott Ross is back with us, and we've been talking about Janet Protasiewicz's win and what that means for looking ahead in Wisconsin. We've done a lot of our looking ahead through the prism of what's going to come before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the 1849 abortion ban, fair maps, things like that. But what does it say about the electorate, especially as we look, you know, to future elections? Now, Scott, one of the things I've said, that one of the things that's forever going to be different is until women's healthcare rights are fully restored, that, you know, that will be an issue that I think will always drive turnout. I don't see that going down. And you see that when there's the right kind of candidate, turnout, organization, messaging, you can get record turnouts in midterms. You can get record turnouts in a spring election, about 40% of the electorate. I'd still like to see that higher, but that was a very encouraging number. What were your thoughts on the turnout numbers, both in November and last week, you know, in terms of where we are past the Dobbs decision?
Yeah, for sure. And I, you know, I mean, I'm from Dane County, where we just seem to, you know, we're seem to be breeding vote, you know, in a way that's just unprecedented. And not only did we see, you know, and like you said, you know, quite correctly, that the Dobbs decision is going to continue to be a central part of elections here in the state of Wisconsin and probably all across the country, that in these Supreme Court races in particular, they are going to be central. Because if, you know, if and when this Supreme Court overturns the 1849 criminal abortion ban, you know, that can be a central issue in the elections coming up in 2025, where progressive and likely Chief Justice Anne Walsh Bradley is up, in 2026, where noxious homophobe Rebecca Bradley is up, and 2027, where, you know, crook Annette Ziegler, the current Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, is also up. After 2027, in theory, you know, progressives could hold six of the seven Supreme Court seats, and every piece of available evidence shows that is entirely possible because of the fact that, you know, Democrats have figured this out. They have finally figured out, like, how to win these races in a consistent way. They've got the money, they've got the message, they've got the motivation, and they've got the machine in order to turn out that vote, like you say, the great turnout. And, you know, at the same time, you know, Republicans are doubling down on, you know, stripping away the rights of women all across the state and all across this country, and really mobilized and galvanized people in this effort. They are doing every other possible thing they can to turn off young voters. I mean, you know, their anti-trans actions, their, you know, work on, you know, their refusal to allow student debt assistance, you know, just top to bottom, this crew is just, it is a dying party. And it's good, because the sort of hate and division that comes out of it is something that should be eradicated from our political well-being, so to speak. But what we're seeing is, not only are Democrats running the score up, and, you know, Ron Johnson, you know, noted scholar Ron Johnson was on the news, you know, in the Journal Sentinel, talking about how, oh, all the Dems did was, you know, get the vote out in Milwaukee and Madison, which is garbage, Pat. Janet won 27 counties, you know, and she swept South Central and Southwestern Wisconsin, right? Which is a lot of Derek Van Orten territory. But she's not the only one to do that recently. Rebecca Dallet did it in 2018, and Joe Kurowski did it in 2020. Like, that Republicans have, ever since, you know, Trump came down the, you know, ever since Trump's election in 2016, Dems have won 15 of 18 statewide races. We're winning every single race where we're competitively funded. And Derek Van Orten is one of the three that we didn't have the resources when we needed them. And that's not going to happen the next time. Hakeem Jeffries has already put, you know, the third CD on the list. He's already put the first CD on the list. And all signs point, both the high turnout in Democratic areas, and, you know, I know I'm going on, I'm sorry, but, like, I just want to point out to all your listeners in Western Wisconsin, like, I am tired of hearing about the wow counties, you know, the Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington counties, and I'm tired of hearing about the bow counties, which is Brown, Outagamie, and Winnebago. How about the French Quarter, Eau Claire and La Crosse, where Janet got 64% in both of those counties? You know, back in 2022, Brad Paff, I think, got, like, what was he? It was like 58, 51, 52 in those three counties. Janet stomped. You know, I included Portage in there as well. Janet got 58% in Portage. I mean, she won 11 of the 19 counties in the third congressional district and tied. Pierce County was actually a tie. So yeah, I guess you have to roll the dice there to see who wins or whatever, draw a card. But it's very clear. Things are going the right way for Democrats. It's because Republicans are wrong on the issues, and it's because Democrats are getting the right candidates and getting the resources they need.
So in terms of that group that we're going to talk to, Cancer Survivor tomorrow, that's rolling this bus tour across the country and stopping in the districts of some of these folks, that really does fall right into, if you were writing the playbook for Wisconsin here, it would be that, you know, you don't wait until the 4th of July, 2024 to start saying, well, here's where Derek Van Orden is getting things wrong. I mean, it's a full-time gig. And while people may not like politics year round, they certainly want to know year round that people care about their issues.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And I think we're seeing that. And, you know, one of the, one of the things about last Tuesday night is, if you look at the numbers, 12 counties that have UW campuses went for Janet Prosewitz. Like the opportunity in terms of the messaging is getting to the people we needed to get to. If you're, you know, from a Democratic perspective, if you're trying to turn out the vote. And I don't know about you, but I think a 27 county, 200,000 vote, 10 point win is a mandate, you know. And what the people said is they want that 1849 criminal abortion ban overturned. They want fair maps. They want public safety. They want their voting rights. They want to make sure that, you know, workers are treated fairly in the workplace, all of those things. And, you know, what we're finding is that the Republicans, you know, are just disqualifying themselves by their extremism and by the way in which they're conducting themselves. And, you know, we had 1.8 million people vote in a spring election, which is, you know, almost unheard of. The only time it's even been close is in 2016, when there was actual, you know, last survivor standing nonsense or whatever. But yeah, it's interesting. I don't want to just focus on the western part of the state, because again, you know, we have that race over in the first congressional district.
Well, but I was going to say, let me ask you about the 8th for a second here, because look, there's no sugarcoating the fact that Tom Tiffany and Glenn Grothman and Scott Fitzgerald, they got no problem appealing to as far right as it gets. They feel like they got safe districts. But in the 8th, you've got Mike Gallagher there, who is trying to create this national profile, chairing this China committee, maybe setting himself up to run against Tammy Baldwin next year. But what I see is, I see the similarity to Paul Ryan of you know how to say these right things that make you sound moderate, but we also watch what you actually do, what you vote for. And, you know, I think that if there were a Democrat to challenge Gallagher in the 8th, that, you know, there is a case that could be made.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Pat, that's a winnable district. You know, the fact is that we're not doing a good enough job of communicating on a day-to-day basis the contrast between these Republican members of Congress and what decency is and what we want out of things. And that's, you know, if I would say there is one glaring part of the infrastructure that's missing for Democrats in the state of Wisconsin, it is that day-to-day communications to ensure that these guys are being held accountable. Because, you know, you create that, you know, you're creating an atmosphere in which people don't see things happening. So they think, oh, it's not worth me trying to run. But the fact is that there's some candidate out there that can beat Mike Gallagher. And there is some candidate out there that can beat Tom Tiffany. And there's some candidate out there that could beat Glenn Grothman. There's a candidate out there that could beat Scott Fitzgerald. Finding that candidate is the important thing to do. But it's also the thing you have to do, you know, before, like you say, July 4th, 2024, you got to be doing that now. And the way you do that now is to force these guys to, you know, have contrast. I mean, how is it that we have not ensured that each one of these clowns has had to be on the record, like Mike Gallagher? Why is Mike Gallagher not on the record about what happened in Texas on Friday related to, you know, banning the abortion pill? You know, that, you know, it shows that the cruelty is what the GOP is all about. You know, and that they were never going to stop at just, you know, banning abortion, that they were going to go after every part of things. And, you know, we'll see, you know, and we have to make sure that they're being held accountable for that. And that's creating those contrasts on a daily basis with communications. I mean, I just, you know, I don't think it's rocket science, because I used to do it for a living and do it not too terrible. So if I could do it, it ain't that hard.
You were masterful at it. You and the entire team at One Wisconsin now for many years were doing that. And if properly called out, you know, local media across Wisconsin, that you don't just have to take the press release, and that, you know, you just do a little research and you can ask some probing questions. And yeah, they get attacked as, you know, how dare you, you know, you must be biased. No, there's no bias in actually asking, you know, intelligent questions.
No, certainly not.
Scott Ross, former executive director of One Wisconsin Now. Always great to talk to you. We're going to do it again very soon. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks much. Have a great day.
All right. We will take a break. And then when we come back, we will talk about watershed protection, spring planting, what a watershed is, why you should care about it. Because, again, we want to make sure people understand you don't just turn on a tap and water comes out clean all magically. It takes an effort, and some folks who work on that effort are going to join us next. You're up north.
Follow Up North News online anytime. Search Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for Up North News WI and our homepage, upnorthnewswi.com.
Hold back water, keep on rolling. Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining?
I picked the Mississippi just because I couldn't come up with a song off the top of my head quick about the Chippewa River. Look, water in Wisconsin can come in different forms. There's the really clear stuff that you find up north where you can see the sandy bottom of a lake, or something here like the Chippewa right outside my door over here. That's a little more, you know, rust in color because of, you know, the iron and other things that are in there. But the water is still, you know, clean, fresh, pure. That's the way we want to keep it. But it doesn't happen, you know, naturally. It takes folks who are mindful of what they're doing near the water or what's being dumped in the water, being aware of things like, you know, erosion and other such matters. And you can do that on a statewide basis, but you can also do it at a hyper-local level. And that's where the concept of a watershed comes in. And that's going to be part of our topic here with our friend Hans Breitenmoser and also with Tara Dawn from the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Hans, how are you? Good to see you again.
Good morning, Pat. Good morning, Tara. I'm fine. How are you guys doing?
Well, great, great. It's good to have you here. Tara, welcome. Good to see you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
She's the watershed coordinator, and we're going to talk a bit about that. Hans, I thought I'd let you kind of lead into this and say that for a lot of folks, especially, you know, from cities, their only experience with the term watershed is if they're on a road trip and you may come by a place, you may come over a hill, most likely, and you see a sign that says you're now entering, you know, the Hay River watershed or something like that. So, you know, what is it about watersheds that, you know, that you tell people, and then we'll get into the more specifics from the actual watershed coordinator herself?
Well, I mean, as a farmer, you know, we're concerned about the watershed because what we do on the land has an impact on surface water and groundwater. So Tara is certainly the expert here, and I'll let her talk about the particulars and the details. But I guess I can speak for myself. We've got plenty of room for improvement, but we're trying to, you know, evolve our practices with cover crops and so forth so that we can, you know, keep more of the nutrients on the land and protect our watershed. Because whether you're a dairy farmer or you live in town, everybody needs clean water, and we should all do our bit, whether it's your backyard or whether it's your back 40, to just sort of be aware of the watershed and groundwater and surface water and how to protect it.
And this is your occasional reminder on terminology that when if you're not familiar with farming and you hear nutrient, a lot of times we're talking manure and fertilizer and things that are nutrients for the crops. But once those things get into the water, they're not so healthy. Tara's watershed coordinator, tell us more about your role.
So I actually work specifically with 4 farmer-led watershed councils here in the Northwest. And then I also work across Northwestern Wisconsin as well with the 11 groups that are currently formed in the area. And the goal of those groups is to find ways that are win-wins. So we want to win for the farmer, been for the watershed. By the watershed, I mean the territory of land that all drains into one water body. So most farmer-led councils are named after the water body that they're talking about. So even though their fields aren't directly adjacent to like the Red Cedar River or the Hay River or the Dry Run, they'll still be part of that watershed because eventually rain falling on that field, if it doesn't infiltrate down, it will roll into the river eventually. So the farmers are looking for ways that they can reduce erosion, which obviously benefits the farmers by keeping their most valuable asset in the field. And they're looking for ways that that can also help the water quality at the river edge as well, or the lake.
Yeah, it's worth noting that, you know, you might hear watershed, but I mean, we all live in a basin of some sort. Think of it that way, that
that's right.
No matter where you are, unless you're at the top of, you know, the very top of a mountain where the water's going to flow both ways, but no, wherever you are, the water's flowing someplace and eventually might make its way to the Mississippi, or it might make its way to the Great Lakes or what have you. But in that local area, it's that watershed that you can look at and do something about. And frankly, Tara, it's those small rivers that I think are just real jewels in Wisconsin. You know, the Red Cedar as it's flowing, you know, just past out of Rice Lake, the Black River as it's flowing through Clark County. These things are just wonders. I would love to live near any of them, but I wouldn't want to live near any of them if it was full of either, you know, manure or topsoil or fertilizer or what have you. So what are the kinds of practices that are typically used so that you can have a healthy agriculture industry and healthy watersheds?
Yeah, well, they really go hand in hand, of course, because we can't have good farming without good water. So really the bread and butter of our farmer-led councils is our basic soil health practices. So reduction of tillage is really a number one goal of a lot of our councils, and also cover crops. When cover crops work well, they like to say nothing works better in terms of soil health and water quality, because those cover crops, which are a crop that goes on after harvest or maybe is interseeded into harvest, it's not for marketing or sale for the farmer to make a profit. It's just there to protect soil health. And the cover crop can take up extra nutrients that might be left in the field from the fertilizer and recycle it in for the next year. So that's great for farmers and that's great for the water. And the cover crop can also hold onto the soil with the root structure, because after harvest, if you don't have any living plant there, that soil is really vulnerable to erosion. So again, by putting a cover crop on, the farmer is protecting their soil for themselves, and they're also keeping that soil and all the nutrients locked up in it from washing into the stream. So those are two main ones that you'll see talked about at almost every farmer-led council. But these are also really local little groups, because we work in relatively small watersheds usually, which means that every group of farmers has different priorities. So we have one group of farmers, the Hay River farmers actually, who provided an incentive this year for farmers to work with an independent agronomist who wouldn't have a hand in wanting to sell them extra fertilizer, for example. So making sure that they're putting on the right amount for their field instead of what might maximize profits for somebody else. We've got the Yahara Pride farmers, which are east of us. They have one for injection of manure, because if you can inject the manure under the soil, it's less likely to roll off the top. Phosphorus indexing is another very common one, and that's because phosphorus is a nutrient that's really important for the plants, but it's also we call it the nutrient of impairment, which means that that's the most pollution that's coming into a water body often. So we have farmers doing soil tests and making sure that they are providing the right amount of nutrient instead of over applying and being inefficient. But there are as many practices that the farmers are incentivizing, which means that they're cost sharing that with other farmers, as there are councils. We come up with all different things, because the cool thing about this program is that the farmers are making it work in their territory. So they're going by where their passion is and what's working right locally for them.
Hans, can you talk from a farmer perspective about that? Because again, you can watch the news and you can see, the fluctuating price of milk or cheese or corn or soybeans, and understand that when farmers are operating on thin margins as it is, you know, now you want us to plant a cover crop, something that doesn't go to market or something like that. I mean, that's where these programs come in, right? To avoid the pushback of saying, I have no financial incentive to do this.
Yeah, I think there's it's hard because, like you said, Pat, we're oftentimes running on pretty thin margins. And so even if you sort of see research that says, hey, this is helping your soil biology and so forth and so on, it's sometimes in farming, we're all about mitigating risk. And if you've done a practice and it's worked, you know, well enough, you're maybe scared to do something a little bit different, try something a little bit different, because that increases the risk, or it feels like it increases the risk. And then also sometimes just having the mental bandwidth to take on other challenges when you're worried about the dollars and cents is tough too. So, but it's good that we have people like Tara to help us, on the farm, with figuring out what best management practices are. And so that, slowly but surely, we as farmers can learn how to implement some of these practices like cover crops. The other thing that we deal with here up in Lincoln County is that we have sort of a short growing season. So some of the things that we hear about and get excited about that are happening in southern Wisconsin or Illinois or Iowa, sometimes they're hard to implement up here, not to make excuses, but it's just we're dealing with a little bit of a different environment from that standpoint.
Well, that's where if you can have that professional help. And look, I understand the Wisconsin Farmers Union is not the same as the University of Wisconsin Extension, but it is in keeping with the Wisconsin idea, is that you take the knowledge base, the technology, even just the encouragement of experts, whether at the UW or the Farmers Union or others, and you put it to work. And so, Tara, I have to think that there's something rather fulfilling about being able to do that in parts of Wisconsin where, the habitat and the environment can be so critical, even as you're trying to make sure, farmers are running a profitable venture.
Yeah. And I would just add in that we don't just focus on extension or the university as research. One of my favorite things that really attracted me to this work and to the Farmers Union is one of our pillars is cooperation, and that's farmers working with other farmers. And so the really great thing about the farmer-led councils is that because they're so local, we have farmers working in those same climatic constraints, like you said, those short seasons. So we're not pulling people up from Madison to tell us how we get cover crops in. We're actually pulling farmers within, 17,000 acres of each other, really, so that they're able to bounce ideas off each other. Well, how did you get your planter to do this? Well, in this really thick soil, how does this? And so you're able to get the really practical on the ground. So, we take the principles from the researchers, but then the farmers are the ones helping each other to really solve these problems and thread that needle.
You talk about these councils, and I know in a blog that you put up for the Wisconsin Farmers Union website, you talk about preventing water quality issues from getting worse, and also to prevent onerous regulations related to water quality for farmers. And that's the balancing act here, is that, and again, we don't mean to turn everything political, but, onerous regulations versus safeguards. And there are just some folks, farmers included, that, anything is onerous. Anything that, it's like, I'm going to do what I want. And meanwhile, you've got others who are extremely cognizant and wanting to do, all that they possibly can. But again, I say this all just to raise that point again. What some people hear as regulation, I almost always hear as protection or safeguard. And I imagine, Tara, that's the kind of framing you sometimes have to do with folks.
Yeah, the way I think about it is that we all have the same interest. There are no farmers out there twirling their mustache and going, I'm going to pollute the watershed today, Marge. Like, we all want the same thing. And so by getting farmers together and talking about how to practically implement the principles, because it's just a difference of priorities or who has the time or investment, right? And so what we are able to do is actually get the farmers excited about taking the things they've heard and making it actually work for them. If we get too excited or too dependent on regulatory measures instead of just doing the right thing and voluntarily taking on soil health practices, we can get regulations that people are following to the letter, but they're not following to the intent. And so one of the beautiful things about this program is it is supported by DACAP, but it's really flexible to provide the farmers the opportunity to do different things that still solve the problem, but also help their farms at the same time.
DATCAP, by the way, that's the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, or the State Ag Department, if you're not familiar with it. And Hans, one last point to make is that the climate is changing, and we've talked before about, you know, you get these rain events, and the rains come harder, and with those larger rainfall events come the increased chance for erosion. And that, again, that's not to say there's nothing that can be done here in Wisconsin that's going to stop an entire global phenomenon, but it does mean we should be aware of it and looking to mitigate some of the effects where we can.
Absolutely. I think that you're absolutely right. We get rain events now that we just didn't get with the frequency that we get now. 3 inches of rain in a matter of a couple of hours and that type of stuff. So our practices have to change because the level of erosion and so forth that potentially we deal with now is different than what it used to be. The extended season that we have does offer us a little more time to put in cover crops, for example. So that's, you know, interesting to note as well. But I think at the farm gate, at the farm level, we have to deal with the consequences of a changing climate. But with our ability to grow cover crops and change our practices, we can also be part of the solution in terms of carbon sequestration and so forth. So that's, I think, what we have to keep in mind, is that we have a unique ability to help solve these problems.
There you go. Hans, thank you. Always good to see you again. Thanks for bringing in Tara, who are going to bring in more often just for the Snidely Whiplash impression. Find out what other voices she does, because that's that's what we're all about here on radio. So, Tara, thank you. Great to meet you. Can't wait to talk to you again. We'll take a break, talk to Chad Holmes from Bull Falls Radio in Wausau after this. You're up north. Yeah, it's clear. It's clear that Mr. Chad Holmes would love for there to be as much blue sky as possible. If you look at his social media feed, he's covering baseball or some softball here. I wouldn't be surprised if you've broadcast from a tennis court. If not, I'm sure that day will come.
No, that's what I have not done. Boy, I haven't even thought about that one.
Yeah, it would be. Come to think of it, although look, I never thought I'd hear things like NASCAR on the radio, and then the first time I heard it, I was kind of hooked, you know, for a time. You know, they did such a great job of describing that. I have listened to golf on the radio once or twice. There's a golf channel, where they've been at the Masters or something. Again, I wouldn't do it all, but no, tennis, come to think of it, I've never heard that on the radio. So
I have heard it. On satellite radio one time. I did hear it when I was driving for one of the majors. And okay. I think you can do almost any sport or any thing.
Oh, sure.
While painting the picture. I mean, if you got those skills, you can do it.
Oh yeah. That reminds me, one of my favorite books, and I got to quickly look up the author here. The book is, Bill Bryson, of course, one of my favorite authors. And the book is called One Summer, America, 1927. Just an excellent book about the year 1927. And Bill Bryson, you should just read everything that he does. Anyway, the reason I bring it up is one of the first things he notes in the book is radio play-by-play of baseball in the beginning sounded nothing like it is today. In the beginning, what the announcer would do was it would be silent. And then as soon as the play ended, they would say, you know, McGillicuddy hit a single to left. And then they'd be quiet till the next. And then finally somebody, and I don't have the book here, so I don't know who it is, but some announcer got to talking during the plays, which was radical at the time. But now, of course, how could you do it without, you know, Bob Uecker or Chad Holmes calling play-by-play, pitch-by-pitch?
I got to tell you, you just dragged Bob Uecker's name through the mud by putting his name right next to my name. You can't do that. No.
Both legends in their own way. But you have been working baseball and softball, or just baseball?
Last Thursday was my first baseball, and then yesterday was my first softball. So, yep, both the boys and the girls.
Okay. All right. And then somewhere in the middle of all that, you managed to do a radio show as well.
I know. I tell you, my mind works in so many different ways, you know, between the issues of the day, and then I get to slum it with doing the sports.
I was going to say, looking through here, you had State Rep Katrina Shanklin on recently talking about state budget priorities. And I'm sure you had a lot to say in the wake of the election.
Yeah. And the thing about, boy, Katrina Shanklin's really impressive. I haven't asked her recently, but again, I would not be surprised. I know she, after the last election in November, is considered. Some folks have been talking to her about being the candidate in the third CD against Derek Van Orden, because the gerrymandered districts back in the day used to be the Portage County, Stevens Point area was in the 7th, but now it's in the 3rd. And I think she has proven to be a pretty good vote getter and someone that's able to talk to everybody, not just be put into the box of, you know, talking to her supporters, but able to work for everybody that she serves in that community. So, again, I think she's one of those younger people. Again, I think that's something that I've kind of mentioned from time to time. Yes, we have some folks, I think, well, the president's done very well, but boy, we got to have that next generation.
Oh, without a doubt. And Katrina Shanklin, one of the things that doesn't get said enough is she is an amazing writer. You know, I see some of her personal social media posts, and I mean, they're inspiring. They really are. So I think folks there are very lucky to have her in public service. I see a tease here. Did you actually get to do a segment with our old friend Oliver Burrows to talk,
I did.
About the political divide? For those folks who don't know, way back in the day, long before Civic Media came along, over there at WXCO, Oliver did one of the shows there, and I appeared every so often with him as a guest. And again, it's just it gets to the power of local radio to talk to local people and get, you know, not just local sports, but local issues as well that you get to get into now as part of your weekday show.
I want to try to do a little more of that, where I'm talking to somebody that, and I'm calling it outside the bubble, because I know that many of us find ourselves talking to people that we always agree with. And I think it's sometimes better to try to widen that net, to try to learn a little something, try to get a perspective other than what we may have ourselves. And who knows, maybe even get a convert or two to an issue or two that I believe in as well. But I just think that, and I know that's something that Sage has talked about, our boss, that we have to be able to talk to a wide range of folks locally and to be able to have a perspective outside of what we may have within our bubble that we can find ourselves in. I think many of us right now in the media landscape is just want to try to provide a perspective that's a little bit different.
What was your take on the voter turnout and the voter results for the Supreme Court race in Wausau, Marathon County, and the surrounding area?
It's always interesting because, again, you know, I think it's been agreed that Dan Kelly was not the greatest of candidates for.
No, he was not. Sorry. said that too loudly, but no, he was not one of the greatest candidates.
But it does show again, I think the hill that has to be climbed here in Marathon County, because he was a double digit winner in this county. And I think, you know, it's been a pretty consistent, I would say, you know, 55-45, 56-44, 57-43 edge for conservatives over liberals in Marathon County. I think here in Wausau, it's a very much tighter and at times maybe a slight edge for the left. But boy, when you get outside of Wausau, it turns very red very quickly. And I think that's, again, something that, again, about talking to those folks and trying to have those dialogues that may, you know, give them a different perspective.
Well, there was no dialogue. You know, what were they hearing? They were hearing the clowns on right-wing media with, you know, just mistruth after mistruth, to put it mildly, you know, just watching basic cable and some of the talking heads on there, and finally giving them some exposure to viewpoints that are, shall we say, a little bit more fact-based or have a little bit more sense of, I don't know, basic human compassion. So maybe we can continue to have an influence, especially with your show. The Brewers lost, starting a 10-game road trip out west to the Diamondbacks, 3-0. I watched the first pitch and then I go to bed, so I don't stay up. But, you know, thankfully these apps and stuff, I over breakfast, I watched all 11 of Zach Gallen's strikeouts for Arizona. And boy, when somebody's curveball is working, isn't it a beautiful thing?
It is, and for the Brewers, they are such the hot and cold team.
Aren't they, though? The bats especially? Yes.
Yeah, I tell you. I mean, when they're off, they're off. And as you say, a lot of strikeouts and not many runs. But when they're on, they're on. So, again, 7-3 is nothing to sneeze at this point.
No. Okay. It's a perfectly fine record. You know, Wade Miley, the Brewers pitcher, noted that the hitters were simply, by the third time through the order, they were picking up what his ball was doing. He couldn't make adjustments, but Zach Gallen didn't have to make any adjustments, man. That curveball was insane. And how'd you like the length of that game? 2 hours and 12 minutes.
We've seen a lot of those so far.
How great is that?
Well, yes. I mean, I tell you, boys, some of those games I used to drag out, all of a sudden, I think the players are really adjusting rather quickly. I think I tend not to give Rob Manfred a whole lot of credit on things, but I think he may have found something here.
I think we have something there. All right, Chad, thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too, Pat.
All right, tomorrow, Representative Francesca Hong, also cancer survivor Laura Packard on a national bus tour about healthcare. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.